We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It is my pleasure to welcome novelists Anne Hood and Margot Livesey to the show this morning. Anne is with me now. Margot will join for the second half of the show. Anne Hood is the author of 9 novels. She's been on the show with Barbara for 2 of them, The Obituary Writer in 2013, and The Knitting Circle in 2007. You can find those interviews up and available on our website. But her latest is The Book That Matters Most, and it is published by Norton. It is out now, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Anne, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I should say welcome back. You've been on a couple of times, so it's always fun to have you back.
Thank you. It's fun to be back.
And I love to see some of the themes that we've talked about in the past pop up here, too. But we'll get into that in a minute. So let me let you introduce the novel. No one does it better than the writer herself. So sort of talk about the book that matters most, what inspired it, and a little bit about it.
So the book is about a woman named Ava who finds herself in middle age alone. Her husband has left her for a yarn bomber, which is kind of a performance art or installation art in which knitters knit public spaces and public statues and trees and all sorts of things. So she's a public figure, making the divorce even more hurtful because everywhere Ava turns, she sees either something that's been yarn bombed or the yarn bomber herself. In an effort to kind of find herself again, she joins a book club, and the book club's theme that year is the book that matters most. Each member has to choose the book that matters most to them. And over the course of a year, they discuss each of those books. Ava has been kind of avoiding for many, many years the event she had when she was a child of a double loss in her family of her mother and her sister. And that summer, she read a book called From Claire to Here that got her through her grief. But in the aftermath of that, she purposely, as she says, chooses books that don't matter at all. She doesn't want to open wounds. She wants to kind of keep moving on. But having to choose the book that matters most forces her to relive that summer and to kind of put to rest the events of her life that have been sort of haunting her. And her story alternates with her daughter, Maddie, who Ava thinks is in Florence studying art history, but the reader and Maggie know that Maggie has left that program and is living in Paris in a destructive relationship with an older man. And in a way, you know, I think of the book as mother and daughter's coming-of-age stories.
Yeah, right. Right. So it's interesting to think about you writing over the course of decades and whether or not you feel like your characters grow up with you. And if you feel like the relationships that your characters have, I was thinking about this mother-daughter relationship, this now adult daughter, and whether you feel like your characters age with you and their areas of concern age with your areas of concern.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if it has to do with the level of maturity. I do think that older writers, and I'm putting myself in that category, who have experienced more of life start addressing more mature themes, perhaps, or looking at the world through a more mature lens. But I still love writing those teenage voices, which I've always loved doing. I think it's because I can remember being a teenager so clearly when I felt like a giant nerve ending, you know, sitting on my bed playing Simon and Garfunkel and the song I Am a Rock, and I would sob and I'd say, I am a rock. You know, I am an island. It was so crazy because I had a perfectly normal, happy teenage year, you know, life. But I just remember that, and I like tapping into that. So Maggie is 20. She's not quite a teenager, but she's a young woman, and, you know, I gave her a lot of that vulnerability and confusion that I remember. So maybe I'm looking at that through a different lens, but I'm not sure the characters are aging with me.
Yeah, I understand that. Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about Maggie and how much research that took. So she lives now in Paris. I don't want to give too much away, but there's some addiction issues. And yeah. I wonder, if that was a hard place to go, if that was a, if it took a lot of research, if it took talking to people who have been through her experience, and kind of talk about mining her character a little bit.
Yeah, so, you know, I knew from the start that I wanted Ava's daughter to be that kid, kind of like every mother's nightmare.
Yeah.
That kid who, with wonderful parents and, you know, kind of a nice life and a good home, for some reason is just wired to be trouble. How much trouble, I wasn't sure. I had her backstory from the start was that she was that kid who, you know, they tried sending to Outward Bound and special schools, and they thought she'd be okay, and then she, you know, did one more thing wrong. And they have finally regained her trust, or, you know, trust her again, and agree to send her to this program in Florence for a year. And they shouldn't have, you know. But what I do know about addiction, and I think what we all know just from reading about it so much and living with it with friends and family members, which we all know someone,
right,
is that they're masterful liars.
Right.
That's Maggie. She can construct elaborate lies, and her mother believes them. So the research really was into heroin addiction in particular, but I think I gave her this combination of vulnerability and tenderness and confusion with an addict's personality thrown into the mix. And then, you know, I originally was going to have her drink too much. And then I realized over the past few years what an epidemic heroin addiction is for people this age, you know, young people. And when I, you know, for the fifth time in so many months was sitting at a table of, you know, upper middle class families, and they're talking about their kids being heroin addicts, I realized, wow, I don't know that this is happening. I've got to learn about it.
Right.
And that kind of dovetailed with creating Maggie. So then I began to research that more.
It is funny. I showed up at a Starbucks the other day, and the regular barista wasn't in. And I said, you know, where is he? And they said, oh, he you know, overdosed. And I was like, what? Uh-huh. I see this guy every, what? And I think
Wow.
You're right. I do think it is. I do think it is an epidemic that,
yeah.
I don't know when it crept in, but it did. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your relationship with book clubs. Book clubs are so near and dear to so many women's hearts, and I always feel like a writer must have a very different relationship with book clubs than the readers do. But anyway, talk a little bit about the kind of the book club being the structure of this book and your relationship with book clubs, and you know, if you feel like they're vital or whatever you have to say about them.
Well, you know, I think they're booming. I really think there's more and more every year. It's incredible, and I realized, because I've been visiting, as you can imagine, for a book that centers around a book club, I have been visiting a lot of book clubs. And I'm always kind of touched and impressed by how they've been meeting for sometimes 30 or more years, and what a community they have formed. You know, they've gotten to each other through loss, through happy times, through changes in lives. In fact, at a book club the other night, one of the women said, when I got divorced, my book club saved my life.
Wow.
You know, I had nobody to listen to me. I had no distractions. You know, she had little kids. And she's still in that book club all these years later. So I think they're viable and a wonderful thing. I wish more men were in them. I mean, I haven't been to one yet where I see a male face. But the one Ava joins does have men in it, because the only book club I was ever in back in the 80s had men and women.
Wow.
And I think I sort of used that model, you know. It can be scary for a writer to go to a book club, because just because you're going, if they didn't like something, they don't hesitate to tell you. You don't want to sit there fighting with your lovely book club members, you know, so you have to kind of grin and bear it, but they're usually pretty kind, but they do let you know that they didn't like the ending, or, you know, they wish this person had run off with that person, or this character wasn't in the book, you know, whatever. So it's kind of interesting. You know, I always say, as a writer, I sit alone for 4 years writing.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I'm thrust into the public, you know, and I'm talking to people, and it's kind of nice to hear what they think about those 4 years I was working.
Right. Right. Yeah. Good. Yeah. personal feedback right there in front of you. I'm not.
Exactly. Terrifying.
You're right. Terrifying. Right. Well, I really liked, I've been a member of a number of book clubs, and I was so jealous of this one. I'm like, wow, these, first of all, it is a mixture of men and women. You know, no one slept together in my book club, so this
is... You gotta change book clubs.
Yeah, I gotta switch book clubs. anyway. So talk a little bit about choosing I should say that to our listeners who haven't yet picked up the book, that the book is sort of loosely structured over the 12 months that this book club meets, around each of the 12 books that each of these people chose as their month for their book. And I was wondering about the choosing the books that mattered the most to these people. It was a wonderful re-walking through a lot of books that I, you know, kind of forgotten about, or books that I haven't yet read and thought, wow, I should probably pick that up. And then, of course, the book that probably has mattered the most to you and what your choice would have been.
Yeah. So when I decided on this book club and their theme, I went out and bought a notebook, and anybody who passed the threshold of my house, I asked, what book matters most to you? And I imagined this notebook was going to be full, that I was going to discover new books or remember, as you said, books I'd read a long time ago. But it became clear pretty quickly that the same 24 books matter the most to people.
Right.
You know, I did have more than 24 answers to the question, but those 24 so dominated, and the most dominant of all was To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yep.
I can't tell you how many people said that book. So at a certain point, I sort of, you know, surrendered to that and said, I want this book club to seem realistic, and I want the books they choose to really be books people would choose, so I'm going to reread these 24 top books and then choose the ones that best reflect the plot and theme of the book that matters most. And so I spent about a year reading these 24 books. Many of them hefty books, I have to say. People like long books. That's my conclusion. But it was kind of delightful, you know. And there were some surprises, like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn and Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. It came up so many times. Huh. Gone with the Wind, which I actually had never read.
No.
I think I had started it, but I was perhaps too young when I started it. Dickens, Not Such a Surprise, War and Peace. So some pretty, you know, the ones you would guess, and others that, like, I was surprised that A Bear of a Lightness of Being was in that top 24. Yeah, so it was quite a fun reading experience or adventure. I think, you know, I put my fictional characters through much harder things than I put myself through. So I think we really can't pick one. I think we real people should get five.
Yeah.
Because it should be the book that mattered most as a kid, the book that matters most as a teenager. You know, at these key points in your life, that book that magically fell into your hand when you needed it. Books have that way of doing that.
Yeah.
And so I would cheat and give several answers, which is, as a child, it was definitely Little Women. I think every female writer wanted to be Jo March, you know.
Right.
In high school, it was definitely Marjorie Morningstar.
Yeah.
And then in college, it was, remember? I mean, I was Marjorie Morningstar.
Yeah.
I got that writer looked into my soul. And then in college, it was The Great Gatsby, because I understood something about what literature does, language and syntax and metaphor, like the things that we certainly learned about in high school, but that book kind of crystallized that for me.
Right.
And, you know, as a young writer, when I was trying to finish my first book, Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine, this is back in 1987, I had multiple points of view, and I could not figure how to string that book together. And in that magical way, I went into a bookstore, and I bought Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant. And I read it, but, you know, by Ann Tyler, and I read it, and I said, oh, I know how to string this together. Like, it was exactly what I needed to read to finish my own book. It was crazy.
It was the book that mattered most.
It was, you know, because I was really at a loss, and I didn't buy it to learn that. It was completely magical that it was multiple points of view that was strung together in a beautiful way. So, you know, that's what happens. That's what's so wonderful about reading.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. I wonder, as you look across the all of the novels that you've written, now nine, if you can see themes, things that keep calling you back, themes that keep reverberating in your head, areas of concern that you can't let go of. I mean, the knitting bomber was the obvious one for me. But just kind of global, either moral issues or character issues or human issues that you can't let go of.
Yeah, you know, I think from that first novel I wrote, Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine, and as I said, it came out in 1987, I have been writing about ordinary people trying to accept loss and moving from grief to a place of hope. And I've tried to do it as realistically as I can, without insulting people who are experiencing grief when they're reading the books. But to me, a novel that, you know, doesn't hold back the hard stuff, but shows the reader that it's going to be better. It's going to be different, but it's going to be better, can be a book that matters most. Yeah. And in the case of Ava in this novel, you know, it's the grief over her marriage ending and trying to find happiness in a new life, redefining herself, which I think is what we're doing all the time, no matter how old we get.
Right, right. Oh, I like that. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Writers on Writing. My guest this morning is Anne Hood. We are talking about The Book That Matters Most. That is the title of the book, The Book That Matters Most. And I wanted to know when you know what as the writer, how much surprise you allow yourself. I don't want to give away kind of the secrets of the ending of the book, obviously, but kind of in abstract terms, how much surprise do you allow yourself as the writer?
I kind of think of myself as like a toddler or a puppy. If I were left without any, you know, my own devices and no boundaries, no planning, I would be putting forks in the electrical socket and falling down the stairs. So I do come up with kind of an outline of sorts. It's not, you know, the Roman numerals outline of high school, but it's a plan. And I feel like within that plan, I discover more than if I'm just writing willy-nilly.
Yeah.
So I do have discovery, definitely, but I also know where I'm going.
That's great.
It's exciting for me how I'm going to get there.
Right, right. And in this book, go ahead.
So I was going to say, it's kind of like doing a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, how am I going to fit the pieces together?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so you kind of have the picture on the box, but you still have the pile of 1,000 pieces. And you just...
Exactly. But I make the border first.
Right. And were there points in here where you got stuck, where you wrote yourself into a corner, and how do you undig yourself?
I do that all the time. I think every writer does. You have this great plan that when you execute it, doesn't make sense. Or with me, because this was spanning many decades, the story, sometimes the math didn't work, you know, and I'd have to go back and say, darn, this had to, you know, this book didn't come out that year. I couldn't. That's, as you know, Jonathan Livingston Seagull makes a little appearance in the book, and it was originally a different book, but that wasn't out yet, so I had to look at what books that year I could use that had the same feeling and landed on that one. So, yeah, a lot of it had to do with just the math of it.
That's funny. Do you have in your office, is it like, do you have like a big whiteboard, or do you have index cards, or do you have a way of keeping track of all that math?
I am a lover of post-its.
Yeah.
And I am a lover of highlighters in bright colors. And there are actually highlighters with post-it notes in them, so my life is complete. That is my favorite tool. You have the highlighter, and you pull the post-it out of it, and it's like, what more the person? I love it. The thing I like about using post-it is you can move them around. You know, so for plot, I might think something's going to occur in the second chapter or third chapter, and then as I'm writing toward it, I see, no, that would deflate tension, so I can just pick up my post-it note you know, move it and switch places with another one, and or crumple them up and throw them away is a frequent thing where at that plot point didn't really work.
Right, right. Yeah, it's, I'm a lover of short stories, a reader of short stories, but also a writer of short stories. And every time I think about trying to tackle a novel, I'm like, how do they do that? It's so much material, so many characters, so much to organize. It's, but I guess the answer is highlighters and post-it notes.
Now you know. So go write a novel. See, I get you everything you need.
Right. If I'd only known it was highlighters and post-it notes.
Exactly.
The other thing I always wonder about novelists and novelists with 9 novels under their belts is not treading on old territory as a writer, coming up with fresh ideas, coming up with fresh characters, coming up with fresh perspectives. And I wonder if that is ever a problem.
You know, I'm answering no sort of quickly, though perhaps readers would feel differently. Maybe they see similarities in characters or situations. But I think there is a comfort in that, too. Like, if I turn to I'm using Ann Tyler today, I guess, an Ann Tyler novel, I'm going to expect a quirky bachelor guy in it. You know, I'm going to expect a woman of a certain age who has certain feelings and conflicts. And I'm happy to see them again because every story is different. But there are, like, familiar things that writers revisit or recycle, but I don't think in a bad way.
Yeah, yeah. And that voice is something of a comfort. I mean, that's why we have our favorite writers, is we
exactly.
turn to them.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
it's like, I like being here. You know, you open that book and you settle in and you're like, I want to be here. I'm like, I've been here and I want to go back.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I like that. My guest this morning is Ann Hood. The book is The Book That Matters Most, and it is published by Norton. It's out now. I wanted to talk a little bit about Hank because I really liked him as a character. He makes a couple of appearances in his own point of view. Without giving too much away, he is a police officer. And talk a little bit about writing from the male point of view, accessing the man's mind, especially a cop's mind.
I know, and I don't even know a cop. So that's
right, right.
You know, I don't think, well, no, I'll say this a different way. I think fiction writers' job, part of our job, is to inhabit all kinds of people. And I didn't think of it differently that he was a man. I didn't even think about the fact that he was a man. I mean, I knew he was, but I didn't think of how I see male in this. I just found him. You know, I found his story and understood him. And, you know, certainly I had male readers early on, or one male reader, and he never once said, oh, that seems like a woman would think or say. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I think it's just an authenticity of the character, whether it's a man or woman, teenager or elderly person. When you find their authenticity, I think you can't, you know, you create them.
Right, right. Oh, he was wonderful. I really...
I loved him. I really did.
Yeah,
I loved
too.
When he was alone in his house.
Yeah.
And then he had a cat that he didn't really like very much.
Yeah.
I liked him.
I liked him too. And I just like the layers of, you know, characters coming together under grief situations, and they, you know, everybody's struggling with their own grief and their own ways of dealing with it, and the way that it affected their life. And I just thought he was wonderful. He was really great.
Thank you.
Well, we're drawing down on our time, but are there things we should have talked about that we didn't talk about before I ask you for your writing advice?
I don't think so. I like what you said about one of the joys I've had in this book is rediscovering not only the books that matter most to my fictional characters, you know, that also matter to the people I talked to when I was writing the book, rediscovering them, but also remembering and celebrating the joy of reading in books.
Yeah, right, right. And you can't help but read this and not go through your own mental list of the books that have impacted you over time. And you're right, it's always different at different periods and points of your life, but
right.
But it was a fun exercise to revisit that, I'm sure, for everybody who's read this. So that was great. I also love that you are a flight attendant. My mom was a flight attendant, so I
she was.
Yeah.
Who'd she fly for?
She flew for Northwest for years, Republic, Hughes Air West. You know, I mean, she's 70 now, so she.
Wow.
Yeah, she was the hot flight attendant of the 60s, and
I love it.
With the yellow go-go boots and the yo-yo. So when I saw you were a flight attendant for TWA, I'm like, that's fantastic. That's
You know, there are other, you know, literary flight attendants out there. Mary Higgins Clark was a flight attendant.
Really? I did not. Yeah. That's great. It is. I mean, you know, the stories you accumulate, I know some of them, but I can't imagine a lot of them. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, you can.
Great writing fodder.
You bet.
I always wonder about that over the course of, well, certainly living through the days of being a flight attendant, but also living through the decades of being a woman writer. I like to ask women writers about their kind of experience of how it's changed for women over the decades, and if you feel like progress has been made, if you feel like there is still a lot of progress to be made, if you're tired of being identified as a woman writer as just opposed to a writer, or if that kind of even enters your consciousness.
Well, you know, I would be foolish to say that it's all great. You know, I think, you know, it still continues that women writers need to form an organization that counts how many female writers are being reviewed in major newspapers and literary journals, and the number is not as high as it should be, that we still have to ask these questions, that many, many writers still believe that Jonathan Franzen can write a book about a family, and it's important, but when women write about that all the time, they're domestic novels. Right. So I think that still exists, unfortunately. I have had a blessed and wonderful career, you know, going on, oh my God, I hate to say it, but going on 30 years. And I have been treated wonderfully, and it's hard for me to complain, but I think I also have to acknowledge that the problem still exists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Always more places we should be going. Yes.
I
agree. Yeah. Exactly. Any writing advice that you can dispense?
You know, I always say the same thing, and I feel like it is what I believe, but I feel like it disappoints people that you have to read everything and you have to just write every day. If you wrote one page a day, you'd have a novel in a year. It wouldn't be good yet. You know, you'd have to revise it, but you would have a draft of a novel. So it's really about doing it. Everybody has a story that they want to tell, but if you want to be a writer, you have to sit down and write it.
You know, although that is common advice, you cannot but help but hear that every day. I think writers need to hear that every day. And even, you know, it's like having a trainer at the gym. You need somebody to stand over you and say, you do. You have to write every day, and you have to read and read outside your comfort zone and outside your normal genre and everything.
That's right. Everything you know, you have to read everything and understand what we're sitting on, what we're resting on, you know, what came before, but also what's happening right now. Like, we're part of a dialogue, a literary dialogue, and you can't write without knowing what that is.
Exactly.
And, you know, I feel like, I don't know, it seems to me it's a recent trend, maybe in the last decade. If I teach a workshop or a class, inevitably, instead of asking writing questions, there's someone who wants me to talk more about publishing. And so other advice I would give is, the rush to publishing isn't helping the writing.
Yeah, right.
You know, focus on learning how to write and on revising and getting something in perfect shape instead of on how to sell it. It's not going to sell if it isn't good, so why are we talking about it?
Exactly right. No, that's right. There is such a rush to, and especially I think the self-publishing world has really fueled that people give up on the regular publishing world and then say, I'll just self-publish. And now we just have a dearth of not great stuff out there. So
absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, to be a writer, you just have to get your hands dirty.
Yeah.
Right.
I love it. That's right. Anne Hood, this is such a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I want to direct people to your website, which is great. And it's got all of your other books on it. I think it's just annhood.us. Is that?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
And I dare say that you do book clubs, but I know that you're doing a book tour. So if people want to find out where you're going to be, that's a great resource for people to go.
Yes, all the events are listed, and there's a contact link. You just hit that, and I receive your emails. I love to hear from people.
That's wonderful. Anne Hood, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Marie. It was great talking to you.
Great to talk to you. That's all the time we have. We're going to take a short break. Please stay with me. Margot Lipsey will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. There's an incredible speaker series event coming up at the end of this month. One of my short story literary heroes, Bonnie Jo Campbell, will be there. There will be a novelist there, so that is definitely should be on your radar. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Margot Lipsey is the author of 8 novels and 1 collection of short stories. She's taught at a number of universities, including right here at UCI, as well as the Iowa Writers Workshop. You can find out all about her novels and collections at her website, margotlipsey.com. It's margotlivesey.com. Her latest novel is Mercury. It's published by Harper, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. It is just now out. It is a great, great read. Margot, welcome.
Thank you so much, Mary. It's very nice to be, in some sense, back at Irvine, even if only electronically.
Only virtually, right, right. When were you here?
I think that I was there in 94, 95. I had some wonderful students in the writing program, including Alice Siebold and Amy Bender.
Oh, what a great class to come up through. That's a powerhouse class.
Yes.
Well, welcome back to campus this morning.
Thank you.
So I'm going to give you a little chance to talk about Mercury, to take us into the, it's just a gorgeous novel and so many layers to it, but nobody introduces a book better than the writer herself. So let me let you talk a little bit about Mercury.
Mercury is about a couple, a white heterosexual couple who live outside Boston. Donald is an optometrist. He is Scottish by birth and by inclination, but has spent a lot of time in America. And he is married to Viv, who grew up in Ann Arbor, and who used to work in mutual funds. But 3 or 4 years before the novel begins, has switched to helping a friend manage a riding stable. Donald and Viv have 2 children, and they live near Donald's parents. And when the novel opens, 2 things have happened. Donald's beloved father has fairly recently died of Parkinson's, and a magnificent horse has arrived at the stables. And as soon as Viv sees Mercury backing out of the horse trailer, she knows this is an amazing athlete, a wonderfully trained horse. And she begins to spend more and more time riding him, training him, and thinking that he is the horse that will enable her to fulfill the dreams of her youth, to be a champion equestrian, right, which she put aside in favor of going into something sensible like business.
Right, right. And this lovely overlay of blindness and sight and what it means to see, what it means to lose your vision, which is such a wonderful metaphor for this couple, what's going on in their marriage. Talk a little bit about that layer of it, how that came to you and how it kind of served the novel as both physical and metaphoric.
I think vision is incredibly fascinating, and I'm very interested in all the different ways we talk about eyes and eyesight. We attribute all this emotion and meaning to a person's eyes, the windows of the soul, and we speak about visions. People having visions. And at the same time, of course, we're very dependent on the physiological mechanism, the actual physical mechanism. At the same time, we see with our brains, in a certain sense, not with our eyes. So the whole subject just strikes me as very fascinating and so rich metaphorically. We can correct our vision, we can be deluded in what we see, our vision can be manipulated, or it can, in the case of Donald's former patient and close friend, Jack, be almost entirely lost.
I really liked the character who was losing it slowly, that she had these shadows coming, and the shadow was getting bigger and bigger. And I thought, what a wonderful image to sort of describe the human condition, that you know, that you can have these shadows in your life that just keep increasing and increasing, and it's very easy to ignore them. You know, how people go about dealing with things or not dealing with things. You know, I think it's very common for people to just let something take over their life and stay ignorant of it.
No, that's completely how I hope the reader would understand the character of Bonnie and this frightening shadow that is occluding her vision in one eye. And one of the most interesting parts about writing Mercury was doing research for the novel, but I think at a certain point, I think I almost overdid it. I'd talked to so many people who'd had problems with their vision and read so many books that I myself was beginning to think that I needed new prescriptions and new lenses.
Sort of the hypochondriac research thing. That's why I don't research too many medical conditions, because I always find that I have them.
Very wise. I would recommend just turning away from the web at such moments.
So let's talk a little bit about that and how much research the book took and how you went about it.
Like many girls, and I hate to be so gender specific, but I think it is mostly girls, I rode as a teenager and loved horses and read tons of books about ponies and gymkhanas and, you know, Bobby wins a blue ribbon, that sort of thing. And then, you know, gradually that got pushed out. This was in Scotland where I grew up. And then gradually that got pushed out of my life by other things. And I confess, ridden that much as an adult, but I have remained very interested in horses and the horse world. So part of the research for Mercury was getting to know that in America and visiting various riding stables and following people around with my notebook and asking lots of rather stupid questions. What are you doing? What are you doing now? and just really watching horses very closely and watching the ways that people relate with them and the way they, I suppose I would say, anthropomorphize them, talk about what the horse is thinking or feeling at certain moments.
How did the original, what was the kernel idea that sparked the novel?
There were two kernel ideas, and I'll tell you them in order, and then I'll put a sort of restriction on one of them, if you... I was talking to an old friend, someone I call a friend but really don't know that well, and he was describing how he and his wife had met at an anti-war demonstration, but now, after many years of marriage, she had become increasingly right-wing, and how distressing he found this. And he said, rather, you know, very sadly, he said, you know, we just don't believe the same things anymore. We're at opposite ends of the political spectrum. And I started thinking about this this very different kind of adultery. I mean, there have been lots of wonderful novels about physical adultery, but what about this other kind? You know, how do you cope with someone changing in those ways? So that was one kernel. And another, and this is where I'd like not to talk not to give away too much of my plot, but to hint at it, was that I wrote a column for the Boston Globe in 2009, and the subject of the column was trying to buy a gun in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And that what that required and what it required was taking a gun safety course and passing a test and various other things. And I was, at the time, I was doing a weekly column for the Boston Globe. I was just for 6 weeks, and my previous columns about things like taxes and gardening had received maybe a dozen nice emails. And when I published this column on, which was implicitly about gun control, I got well over 100 emails and also half a dozen messages on my home telephone saying things like, "You're a Scottish immigrant, you're lucky the American army is prepared to defend you."
Wow.
And I realized I'd really touched a nerve. And at the time, I was deep in writing another novel, but I kept thinking about that and about guns, about the whole culture, whole complicated culture around guns, which is not just one culture, of course, but many cultures.
What year was that article, did you say? 2009?
That was in 2009.
Wow. Things have gotten so much better, haven't they?
Yes. They've improved so dramatically.
Right.
And I've also had a long-standing interest in ambition and how we judge, how we value ambition, and what happens when ambition turns to something we judge to be obsession.
I love all of these, and the way you brought them all together is just stunning. It's just stunning. I will remind our listeners that you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and my guest this morning is Margot Livesey. I love hearing you say your name. I'm saying your name correctly. Yes. No.
Mary, you're saying my name perfectly. Thank you.
I get very paranoid about this because I'm so notorious for botching names, and it really upsets me. So I and nobody anyway, that's perfect. Let's talk a little bit about Donald. He was such a wonderful character. I want to talk about your decision to write from the male point of view, which you've done in the past as well, and your skill and mastery with that, and kind of understanding him, how you came to know him, how he was mined in your head a little bit.
Thank you for that very elegantly phrased question. Writing about Donald became a deep pleasure. He was modeled on people I saw around me in my childhood, these upright Scottish school teachers. My father taught at a boys' school, so I was surrounded by these men. And I was very, one of the things that was both admirable and sometimes a little complicated was how they thought of themselves as good men and how they wanted to be good men and to do the right thing. And happily at the boys' school where my father taught, most of them weren't tested in the ways that Donald is tested in Mercury. And I wanted to create a character who would be empathetic, would also be myopic in certain ways, that in the aftermath of his father's death, he doesn't really understand the ways that his grief has affected him. He thinks he's just getting on with his life and taking care of his children and being a good husband, and he just doesn't fully understand the ways he's not really listening to Viv, not paying attention to her. And at the same time, you know, he too has his ambitions. He would like to return to surgery, something he trained to do but gave up to take care of his father and his family. And that too is a sort of a small strand of the novel. He has his ambitions, but unlike Viv, he won't go as far as she does.
Right, right. I had to laugh. The novel opens, and I'm going to let you read the opening, but the novel opens with some discussion of his name and how unusual his name is. It's just so funny in the current political climate. I know our conversation keeps veering into the political, but...
his name is of course a huge source of consternation to me at this point. When I began the novel in 2012, I had no idea it was going to become, well, it was going to become a name we were constantly hearing.
Right, right, right. Well, with that, let me have you read the introduction, and we can all laugh together, shall we?
Thank you, Mary. My mother called me after a favorite uncle, who was in turn called after a Scottish king. Donald III was 60 when he first ascended the throne in 1093. He went on to reign twice, briefly and disastrously. As a child, I hated my name. Other children sang, "Donald, where's your trousers?" in the playground. But as an adult, I've come to appreciate being named after a valiant late bloomer, a man who seized the day. Of course, most Americans, when I introduce myself, are thinking not about Scottish history, but about a cartoon duck. They are surprised when I tell them that a Scot invented penicillin and that James VI, for whom the Bible was so gloriously translated, was a keen amateur dentist. I used to believe that in my modest fashion, I was contributing to the spread of Scottish values. Thrift, industry, integrity. I have my own business, a full-service optometrist, in a town outside Boston. More than most people, I have tested the hypothesis that the eye is the window to the soul.
That's great. That was Margot Livesey reading from her latest novel, Mercury, which is just out, is published by Harper's, and out in bookstores now. Let's talk a little bit about you... The way you construct novels is incredibly complex. It's sort of like puzzle pieces coming together. And I as I was reading this, I was trying to figure out if there was information that, even small amounts of information that I knew, how I came to know it, like that they were vegetarian. Somewhere it became apparent to me that they were vegetarian, but I thought, did I even know that before this? And so the way that you disseminate information to the reader, I think, is incredibly interesting, incredibly effective, but it struck me as difficult to construct this novel. I don't know if there's a way to talk about how you put this together and how you give information to your reader as it becomes necessary for them to have it, but I found that fascinating in this book.
Thank you. I think I probably say this about every novel. It was a hard novel to write. I did originally conceive of the novel as being told entirely by Donald. And then at a certain point, for a number of reasons, I felt that not giving Viv's point of view was a real shortcoming, that it was essential to understand some of the ways in which she comes to make the decisions she makes that are so injurious to her family and those around her, that we had to see her inner workings and the steps she takes. And that was sort of course, as soon as I decided that changed the novel greatly. Mm. And the question was, you know, how to weave their two parts together and when to interrupt Donald's narrative and introduce Viv's, and what parts of the story each of them should tell. And I think of the novel as, you know, Donald is the one who finally has to make some very, very difficult decisions. And so he does tell the bulk of the story, but Viv has a significant portion. And of course, I hope part of what she conveys is how incredibly important to her Mercury is. He's not just a horse. He represents so many things in her life.
Right, right. Did you write the novel sort of A to B, or tell me a little bit about the revision process and how it kind of came out?
I did write the novel, you know, pretty much as you read it, with a number of detours and false turns. I sent an early version of part one told by Donald to my agent and editor, and they both asked some very helpful questions, which I didn't exactly answer in part one, but which gave me a sense of what I needed to do in the rest of the novel. And, of course, as I learned new things about horses and other aspects of the novel into which I did research, that too began to shape and morph the material.
Right, right. I wonder, as you have approached the novels, there have been eight of them now in one collection of short stories. Is the approach similar in each one? How you sit down to write it, how you mine the characters, how you lay out your office to kind of look at, you know, the big plot pictures, or does each one require and tell you its own way to approach it? Does that make sense?
I think it varies quite a bit from novel to novel. In the 90s, I wrote a novel called Criminals, and I, basically wrote much of a first draft in 3 weeks and then revised it for a year. Around that time, I was also working on a novel called Eva Moves the Furniture, which I wrote over 12 years, stopping to write other novels because I just couldn't make Eva Moves the Furniture work. The furniture wasn't moving.
Wasn't moving.
And in the case of the novel I published just before Mercury, The Flight of Gemma Hardy, it was in part a reimagining of Jane Eyre set in 1960s Scotland. So that caused a different approach because I knew more about where the novel was going than I usually do. And at the same time, I had a very clear sense of some of the difficulties and threats, if you will, of writing in the shadow of a masterpiece.
Right, right. As you look across those eight, now nine, can you see themes that have haunted you over the decades, things that you keep returning to? Areas of concern that you keep digging into and kind of common themes across them?
I think there are a number of common themes in my novels. I think I'm very interested in moral issues, in ethical questions. I think that I'm really interested in plot and what plot can do for a novel, and I aspire to have quite suspenseful, fast-moving plots. I think that I'm very interested in betrayal of various kinds, and how people betray those around them, sometimes wittingly and sometimes unwittingly, and how we fail each other through moments of inattention, if you will.
You know what I also really enjoyed about this was, and this will obviously reverberate in Anne Hood's book as well, this ability of literature to save us, to be either redemptive or a source of solace, and that certainly was true of the Edward character in here. I know that's been true of characters of yours in the past, love of poetry, love of Shakespeare, and the kind of the power of literature to heal. I wonder if that's on your mind.
It is very much on my mind. I mean, I am unabashedly a reader, and I hope I'll keep writing for many years to come, but I could probably sort of survive without writing, whereas I couldn't survive a week without reading. And so I think that does sneak into my books, even though I try to keep it out and try not to have all my characters quoting Keats and Shakespeare and reminding each other to pick up, the latest masterpiece.
That's funny. I also wanted to talk to you about being a woman writer and how that, if you feel like anything has changed over the decades that you've been writing for women in this field. There's some talk about, women not being nominated for all of the prizes that men are. Have you felt any shifts or changes, or does this not even kind of enter your consciousness as you write?
I don't it enters my consciousness while I write, which is probably a good thing. But, of course, it does enter my consciousness when I step away from my desk or step into a bookshop or pick up a newspaper or listen to the radio. And I do think things are improving. At the same time, I do think that it is still harder for a woman writer to be taken seriously. And, of course, the other side of that is that women are often wonderful readers and perhaps read more fiction than men often do. So it's a complicated question, and I think most of the writers I know who are women are aspiring to be writers first and women writers second, just as I would say most of the minority writers I know are aspiring to be writers first. And
well said, yeah, that's right.
But I hope we'll keep making progress in this direction.
Yes, me too. You're a fiction editor at Plowshares still, are you?
I gave that up last year when I was fortunate enough to be offered a job at the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Oh, yeah.
I worried that I would be reading too much fiction in too many places.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that would be a daunting task. I'm wondering through the course through your editing and through your teaching, if there are common mistakes, pitfalls that you see writers, new or old, making that that you can try and talk us out of.
Oh, this is a tall order, Mary. I would say I'm trying to talk myself out of common problems. I do think that there is pressure to make our work new, whatever we mean by that. In one of her essays, Virginia Woolf talks about how quickly the world is changing and how it's up to writers to respond to those changes. And I do think we see things today in 2016 that we didn't see even in 2006. So I think one of the hard things is not to fall into certain cliches or stereotypes as we start to write, to limit our characters and their possibility for surprising both us and our readers. And I think it's interesting how when we sit down to write, our vision sometimes becomes quite narrow. And one of the things I suggest to my students is to try writing in public places. When you're describing a character, look around you and think how you've described the person at the next table, and then see if you can bring some of that complexity to your character.
I love that. That's great advice. I do think people get a little bit, you know, caught up in their own head and world and looking up and looking out and listening. I love sitting in coffee shops and just listening to people's conversations. You can't believe the things people will say. So
I know. It's endlessly fascinating.
It is endlessly fascinating.
Eavesdropping is one of the things writers just absolutely have to do.
Yes. Yeah, speak into my pen and good things always This is a delight. Is there anything that we should have talked about that we didn't, that you wanted to say that we didn't get to say?
I think that you asked such wonderful questions, Mary, that you allowed me to say many of the things that I wanted to say. And I suppose the biggest one is that I hope I've written a novel that is complicated and suspenseful and that will make the reader think, well, what would I do if I was in this situation? Would I take that step or would I step aside?
Yeah, you really are the master of that. I mean, this was really an unputdownable book, and it does raise a lot of moral and personal questions that I think, you know, every marriage faces in its own way, or every relationship in general faces in its own way. As you pointed out, or somebody pointed out, of the Tolstoy saying that we're all unhappy in our own unique ways. However, that I just botched that quote, but
but we all knew what you meant.
Thank you. Yes, and
I think, you know, in the 19th century, novels used to end, you know, reader, I married him, and in the 21st century, we're aware that entering into a long relationship is entering into something wonderful, but very complicated.
Exactly. Isn't that the beauty of the human experience? Something wonderful and complicated. This was great.
Yes, and endlessly interesting if we're lucky.
Yes, yes, yes. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.